Christmas, Robert.
Happy Christmas, Christopher.
Hello and welcome to the Christmas special of Still Any Good, the Yuletide podcast where we run the seasonal risk of ruining fondly remembered festive films. My name's Christmas Webb, and I'm joined by someone who has a massive bag of Swedish meatballs. It's Robert Johnson.
Hello, how are you?
How are you keeping, all right?
I'm good. Merry Christmas.
Nadolig Llawen.
Thank you. How's your break going? Are you on leave from work yet? Or
not yet. No, I'm working till Christmas Eve.
Oh.
Which is nice. It's deemed important in my job that people will still want to come and see us up until 4 o'clock on Christmas Eve. So that's nice.
Fair enough.
How about you?
I had my first day of leave yesterday. Saw my partner and our little baby son off at the airport, and I won't be seeing them again for another week. So for the first time since my son was born 8 months ago, I have the house to myself for a week. So
is that a good thing or is that a sad thing?
It's a sad thing, but I was a little bit emotional yesterday, actually, and a little bit this morning as well, and I'll keep trying to FaceTime them. But I think I'm going to ease into it. I'm going to enjoy being able to play the PlayStation again, go out and just grab a coffee again, just have a bit of me time, read a book.
Sleep.
No, I'll be joining them on about the 23rd up in Hawke's Bay where all our families are, so that'll be nice.
And you're coming to see me, aren't you?
I'll definitely come and see you. I'll bring River over to see his Uncle Chris.
That'd be brilliant. He can meet the other podcast children. He can meet my kids. That'd be great. Yeah.
Poor kids.
I know. Little abandoned children. Anyway. We are not alone. I thought I'd mention that. We've got somebody listening in to us today.
Oh, okay.
We have another very, very special guest. Today, we are joined by, let me call him a broadcasting all-rounder. He's a TV reviewer, a producer, a presenter, a writer, and something about having a bath with the Spice Girls. So let's say a big hello to Simon London.
Hello, Simon.
Hello, and good day. Good day. It's the Australians we say good day to, but I'm saying good day to anybody who may be listening to this in case it's in the day and not the night or the morning or whatever. So good day to you both, and thank you for having me on as a guest.
Well, thank you for joining us on our show. I have to say, Simon, you've got a special place in both Chris and my heart. My first child was born this year. As he was delivered, you know, that moment is probably a close second to having you give us a positive review on BBC Radio London. So,
well, it's always nice when people recommend podcasts to me, but I think your podcast was one that I think I stumbled across it, and I listened to the Basic Instinct one, and I was like, I love these guys. I just liked the slight reticence in really going for it. But also, you were talking about a film that I love, and actually, it's a great idea to call the podcast Still Any Good, because I thought that I absolutely loved this film that we're going to talk about, and I do. But looking through it, through that critical eye of, do I still love it in the same way I loved it as a kid, really makes you reevaluate it in a completely different way. And it works so well. So, yeah, it's a great, great podcast. And my pleasure to talk about it this year.
And I will say the main reason we called it Still Any Good is because there is another podcast called The Test of Time, which was our first choice. Oh, sods.
See what they've done there.
Because you're our guest, you've chosen a film for tonight. So what have we got?
We have Trading Places, the John Landis-directed comedy starring Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy.
I had the most absurd nightmare. I was poor and no one liked me.
I know what you're thinking. You see Foggy and Beth? We can make it, baby! Me and you!
Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are trading places.
Help! Help!
I don't want your bag, man.
Help! 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 Help!
I'll bet that man could run our company as well as your young Winthorpe.
Are we talking about a wager, Randolph?
Is there a problem, officer?
Oh, Winthorpe. I'm glad your parents are not alive to see this.
Wait, now this is totally preposterous. I'm not a thief.
Here we are, William.
Take off your clothes.
You are making a career decision here.
Take off your clothes.
Did you hear what this man said to me? I have witnesses.
This man is physically threatening me.
Hey, Randy, Morty, this is nice. I like this.
We are commodities brokers, William. Commodities are agricultural products, like wheat, which is used to make bread, pork bellies, which is used to make bacon, which you might find in a bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich.
I'm considering going long on April wheat. What do you think, Valentine?
Freeze, Slimeball!
Moi?
Put that gun away at once, Winthorpe. You lost your mind?
Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy. They're not just getting rich, they're getting even.
Do you have any better ideas?
Yeah, you know, it occurs to me that the best way you hurt rich people is by turning them into poor people.
Dan Aykroyd. Eddie Murphy. Ralph Bellamy.
We've got to get Wilson and tear up the sale!
Don Amici.
Randolph, this isn't Monopoly money we're playing with.
Denham Elliott.
What a scumbag.
And Jamie Lee Curtis.
By the way, food and rent, not the only things around here that cost money. You sleep on the couch.
Trading Places. It's a very funny business.
Southdown in April of 142!
Yeah, not many people think of it as a Christmas film, but this has Christmas and New Year's Eve running through the very heart of it. So it very much is a Christmas film.
So what does this film mean to you? Why did you choose this particular Christmas and New Year's film?
When I think of Trading Places, I think of Eddie Murphy at his best. He was kind of this rising star. He'd made 48 hours with Nick Nolte. What I didn't realise is that they weren't quite sure how that was going to work, so they held it back and it hadn't been released, even though he made it before Trading Places. So Trading Places was the first film that sort of came out showing what he was capable of doing. And then they released 48 hours off the back of it. And by his third film was Beverly Hills Cop. So in three films, he became this huge star, and I believe he's the only member of the Saturday Night Live team to actually host the show while still being a member of the team. So that's how big he was. It would have been mad for them not to have him as the biggest comedy star in America hosting the show, but he was actually still a member of the ensemble cast, and I just love that fact. So this is kind of prime Eddie Murphy at his best. And of course, Dan Aykroyd had done the Blues Brothers and would go on next year to make Ghostbusters. So these are two actors kind of on the way up, if not just at the top of their game, which they stayed at for a good sort of 5-6 years.
And a breakout performance for Jamie Lee Curtis as well, of course.
Indeed. Yes, so there's a lot to talk about with Jamie Lee Curtis in this film. If you were a kid in 1983, as I was, she's etched on your memory. And I did a little bit of research last night and looked at some people talking about the film and the making of and stuff like that. And it's funny, everybody talks about why Jamie Lee Curtis was so memorable in this film, including her. But also, I didn't realise that John Landis really had to fight for her to get the role, because she had done Halloween. And she was known as a scream queen and not taken seriously. And the idea of her doing comedy, I guess, was sort of a bit like Vince Gilligan trying to convince everybody that Bryan Cranston would be great as Walter White in Breaking Bad after everybody had seen him in Malcolm in the Middle. So, yeah, really a massive breakout role for her as well. And she's great in it.
Yeah, I think what surprised me really is looking at her back catalogue before this, other than things like The Love Boat and Columbo, it literally was all horror. There were the two Halloweens, I think Terror Train. Was she in Prom Night as well? Was that the other one? And that was all she'd done. So it's really surprising. When I first saw this, which was on the video release when it came out, so I would have seen it in around about 1984 when I was 13 years old, she already seemed like a household name. And I would have seen Halloween by that time, but she just seemed to me like a Hollywood star already. The timing of this film really surprised me. I always thought it was much later in the 1980s because everybody feels so established in it.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Like I say, the Paramount was sitting on 48 Hours.
Mm.
So it was kind of like they weren't sure about the pairing of Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy in that film. They didn't think it was a great film. Whilst they were kind of just starting to do Trading Places, they tested it and the audience loved it. So they knew they had a hit on their hands. And then it was just a case of waiting for the schedule. I mean, I think a lot of people forget that, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, your blockbuster, you'd have about 40 films that you would release during the summer. Mm. I mean, the year that this came out, it was vying against Return of the Jedi as the summer blockbuster. You know, when was it going to be released? And Return of the Jedi, Superman 3... and the James Bond film Octopussy, which means if Octopussy was out then Never Say Never Again must have been out as well. Yeah. So some really big franchise names. And for this film to come out and do better, I think it did better than... It outsold Superman 3.
Mm.
Return of the Jedi was obviously this juggernaut it was never going to touch, but it kind of held its own in that blockbuster summer period. So they were waiting to put out 48 Hours as well. So everybody kind of knew the people in it waiting for, as you say, they felt established, but they hadn't really done anything huge yet.
What about you, Rob? What's your memory of this?
I have many, many childhood memories of this. And as Simon alluded to, I think there was one part of our VCR tape that was a little bit scratchy from overuse. And it was
the stock market bit, wasn't it?
Definitely a Jamie Lee Curtis moment. This was a film that me and my brother's about 7 years older than me. And it was one that would always come on about Christmas, New Year's time. If it was on, the two of us would always watch it together. It was just one of those films that could, you know, as me as a 8 or 9 year old and my brother as a teenager could still watch together and enjoy. I had absolutely no idea what all the financial intricacies meant, and quite frankly, I still don't. But
no, absolutely not.
But yeah, it was just a comforting film. That's how I remember it.
Yeah, so like I said, I was 13 when it came out, and I wasn't any kind of sort of film nerd. I didn't really get into cinema until probably like in my 20s. But I knew who everybody was, even John Landis. I knew he was the director of this film. I'd already seen Animal House, Blues Brothers and American Werewolf in London at obviously way too young an age, but I knew who the director was. I even recognised the font, which sounds a ridiculous thing to say, but he's got his own font.
So
I recognise some of the other names in the credits.
George Foley.
George Falsey Jr. and Elmer Bernstein.
That's so
their
true.
Names all come up.
Yes.
Which is why I thought it was in the late 80s, because it's so embedded.
Academy Award nominated soundtrack, of course, by Elmer Bernstein.
Yes, yes it is, yeah. Is it Marriage of Figaro that he borrowed from?
Yeah. And of course, this would be the last film that Landis made before he encountered his legal troubles with the lawsuit about the accidental deaths of several actors on The Twilight Zone. And he only really had about 3 more decent films in him, really, after this. Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, Coming to America, which Eddie Murphy sort of gave him almost as a favour because his career was in the doldrums. Yeah, things never really panned out the way they should have for John Landis.
Yeah, because I'd read some interviews with Eddie Murphy saying that John Landis had never really forgiven him for not appearing as a character witness at the trial. And so he gave him a bit of a hard time on Coming to America.
Because they had a massive falling out on the set,
didn't they?
But they still worked together again for Beverly Hills Cop 3, I think. But yeah.
We'll say no more about that.
Yes.
So the other thing about this is it's from quite good writing stock as well. It's Harrison Weingrod. Mm. And I think this was their first or second screenplay, and they then went on to write things like Twins and Kindergarten Cop and Brewster's Millions. Yeah. So very high-concept writers. They're very much, what if something ridiculous happens and what can we do with it?
And it was intended as a project for Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder.
That's right.
Yeah, I love that idea. And of course, when you say that, you kind of go, I see that film.
Mm. Yeah,
I can completely see that. That would have been a great film. I don't know.
It would have, actually, yeah.
I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. And it would have been, I could see how that film would look and how it would sound and everything else. And it's testament to the characters that are in it, Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy, that they've kind of stamped themselves on this in the way that they have. I don't think I would like to see it remade. I don't think I'd like to see kind of like a Kevin Hart. Who would remake it? It would definitely be Kevin
It'd be
Hart.
Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart. There you go. I've cast it.
yes, like you say, they were the masters of the high concept film. And I'm sure we'll talk about this. As you say, I still don't understand the denouement of the film and how the futures bit work. I read up on it last night again, and there's a whole internet site devoted to explaining the end of the film. And it is testament to the writing that actually the comeuppance of the two brothers is in effect a MacGuffin. Because all we care about is the relationship between Aykroyd and Murphy and how that plays out.
Like you, I tried. I even did little drawings and almost got as far as doing flowcharts to try and understand what was going on. And I still don't get it. But it doesn't matter. You just go along with it. You know that what they're doing means that they're winning and the Dukes are losing.
Mm.
I sort of compare it to bail bonds in Midnight Run. Haven't got a clue what they are. Doesn't matter. Just get on with it.
It's too abstract.
Yeah, I have no idea how bail bonds work. They don't appear anywhere else other than America. Don't care. You know it matters and it keeps the story going. And I suppose it's similar to one that Rob and I reviewed many, many years ago, which is bootlegging in Smokey and the Bandit, which is bringing beer from one state to another is illegal. Okay, just get on with it, that's fine. We'll swallow that. That's okay.
Now you've said that. What is really interesting, though, again, like you're saying, the brilliance of your podcast is making you reevaluate it. So I've always watched this film for pleasure, so never ever with a critical eye on it at all. When I had to sit down and watch it with a critical eye, you know, just for a second, which I guess is the whole point behind the podcast, I was like, is this really such a favourite film of mine? The ending is labyrinthian, so there is no other word for it. And if you've been somebody who's kind of sat through Memento and had to try and explain Tenet to your 19-year-old son and going, I think that's right. You know, I found those easier to understand and explain than the ending of this film. And as I was watching it, I was going, these characters are so funny and I love them, but actually they're so two-dimensional. There's nothing there. We don't know anything about Billy Ray Valentine, Eddie Murphy's character. We don't know anything of his... He doesn't appear to have any friends. There's no backstory for him. There's a really interesting backstory for the Dan Aykroyd character, Lewis, in that at one point they say, if your mother and father are alive to see you now, and you realise that the house he lives in is owned by the Dukes, and you're kind of, well, where's he come from? Is he related to them? Is he sort of a godchild or whatever? You don't know at all. And in some ways, you don't really know anything about the Jamie Lee Curtis character. The Dukes, you get a bit more sense of. They're from old money and they've always been rich and one thing another. We know nothing about Denham Elliott's character and why he switches sides so easily. We assume it's because the little bits we see of the Dukes kind of being quite nasty to their staff or being quite cold is motivation enough. But these characters have no depth. They're incredibly two-dimensional. They undergo a change. At one point, Eddie Murphy stops talking like the street kid and starts talking as though he went to Harvard. And there is no 80s montage sequence where we see him being trained to dress properly or eat with the food. And kind of it's sort of the first half is incredibly pantomime. The second half is incredibly convoluted. I mean, I love this film and I didn't realise, I completely forgot that Dan Aykroyd is in blackface on the train.
And sort of,
you know, this is something that's made the film run into problems later on. But looking at it, you can't really complain about him being in blackface because he sat next to Denham Elliott playing a stereotypical priest, Irish priest with a drinking problem. You've got Jamie Lee Curtis in sexy lederhosen putting on an accent, pretending that she's from Switzerland. And you've got Eddie Murphy playing this over-the-top African Cameroon prince, sort of like the prototype for Coming to America. And it would be insensitive to me to sit there and go, oh my God, look at Dan Aykroyd in blackface. He's being so racist, when an Irish person can sit next to me and go, well, look at Denham Elliott. They're all being mad stereotypes. So I think I give them a pass for that scene completely. It just doesn't feel offensive. It just feels part of the high camp pantomime comedy of this film.
You know, there is some stuff that is thought to have aged a bit badly and become a bit problematic, as you say. I think this year even Sky UK added a disclaimer saying it's got outdated attitudes, language and cultural depictions sort of in the climate of Black Lives Matter and George Floyd protests and things. So yeah, it's interesting to hear that you're giving them a pass for the blackface.
But I think, I don't know, do you guys agree when you see them all sat in that train carriage? It doesn't feel massively uncomfortable to me. I mean, Dan Aykroyd, it's so over the top. It's so ridiculously over the top. And there's four racial stereotypes completely over the top there.
There's, of course, the scene where Don Ameche, mentions the N-word and says that, you know, we'd never have that person running our family, and it's immediately agreed to. And I think a lot of that scene is actually removed or censored in a lot of showings of this, whereas I actually think that's actually quite a powerful attitude to get across, you know.
Well, it's painting them as the awful people we know they are. It's hammering the nail in, isn't it?
Encapsulates what sort of monsters these people really are.
Yeah, I think it's a massive mistake to remove that scene, because up until now, you know, there is an ambiguity about, are these guys kind of just horrible because they're rich guys who are detached from everyday life? I mean, there's a great line where they tip the waiter in the club and they go, oh, you thought I'd forgotten your Christmas bonus, and give him $5. And that's back in 1983. And he says brilliantly, thank you, maybe I'll go to the cinema by myself, as he pockets it. yeah, Don Ameche says, half of it was from me.
Yeah, yeah, and then he mouths, motherfuckers.
Yeah, but then... you know, but they kind of treat everybody like that. But actually, that scene where he comes out and says, no, we'd never let our company be run by a... Then he says the N-word. You kind of go, whoa, these guys really...
Yeah.
You know, these guys really are horrible. Mm. I think, again, it's got to be contextualized. And also, this is, without kind of being too pretentious about it, this is art. This is an art form. And these are characters who have dialogue written for them, which helps us to explain their motivations and who they are and what they are and why we feel so happy when they get their comeuppance. Taking bits and pieces out like that actually has an impact on the story and the emotive element of the story. I think that we need to be really, really careful when we go back and censor art.
I think the only instance where it possibly slips up is towards the end, where Dan Aykroyd uses, let's call it the slightly less offensive N-word, the one that was kind of still acceptable in the Deep South in the 1960s. Obviously, in the beginning, he believes he's being mugged. A black man bumps into him, and so he therefore believes he's being mugged. So he's got that driven-in racism, if you like, that casual racism. But then towards the end, where he's gone through this horrible journey, and he wakes up thinking it's all been a dream, and then he kind of says this awful, terrible, lowercase N-word, and you think, shit, have you learnt nothing? You're still awful. That's the only time I kind of think, I don't know, but... You're absolutely right with everything else. It's contextual, yeah.
You wouldn't cut it out, though.
No.
I think it's sort of, it's important. So as we're saying, written by people with a track record of writing good material, completely unfathomable in the end, and the characters massively two-dimensional, and the story arc a bit sort of all over the place. But it works. It works brilliantly. And I think that must be down to the direction of John Landis. So it's amazing just how many off-camera jokes there are and how he frames the shots. And he is a great comedy director. And watching it again to be critical this time, I was like, oh, that is good comedy. You know, Dan Aykroyd throwing a gun away and out of shot you hear it fire. And the gun that he's just tried to take his life with, he's held up to his forehead, pulled the trigger, and it hasn't gone off. And then he just chucks it away and you just hear it fire. That's a great joke that you can only really do in cinema, that I think. I guess you could do it in theatre. But it's a great joke, and the timing of it is really good. But... yeah, as I say, it's a plot full of holes like Swiss cheese, but it really is. It's really the power of those three people, really. Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd and John Landis's direction that makes this such a strong film.
And what about the Duke brothers, Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche? Don Ameche's first film in a decade, I think, and then his next role, he'd go on to win an Oscar for his performance in Cocoon.
Again, just doing a little bit of reading behind it, the only reason he hadn't done any films for 10 years, he said nobody had asked him. Nobody had asked him. He was kind of independently wealthy from all the films that he'd made kind of back in the 30s and 40s. And so he was happy and ready to go. there is something to be said for casting great actors, you know, even if the roles feel small. And didn't somebody famously say there are no small roles, there are only small actors? These are huge actors in the supporting cast, and they are great because they are pantomime villains, but they're also their ability to work with Eddie Murphy. And I understand now, which I didn't know, that some of the scenes, or quite a few of the scenes, he was improvising, as you would expect him to do. And just the way they go with it and the way that they deal with him, I mean, back there in the 1980s, they would not have been making films with this much screen time with a young black guy. I think Eddie Murphy's 23, 24. And Eddie Murphy's really street as well. You know, they would not be kind of dealing with him in their normal lives anyway. And then to be acting with him whilst he's kind of going off script and everything else, you see them for the consummate professionals they are. And they're able to keep up that level of reality, or what they call verisimilitude, I think. They're able to keep up that level whilst at the same time being ridiculously, like, you know, half of it was from me. They deliver those zingers perfectly. Yeah. And they're kind of like the ugly sisters in Cinderella. They are these pantomime villains. I think they do it brilliantly.
Well, they are veterans of screwball comedy as well. I mean, Ralph Bellamy famously in things like His Girl Friday and stuff like that. And Don Amici in, I think this was his 100th film or something. So they really do play to type in this, and this was intended to be a sort of a revival of the screwball comedy, albeit with more capitalist attitudes towards the end.
Yeah, I was reading that too, Chris, that, you know, this was an updated social satire screwball comedy, but there was some criticism that it didn't have the same sort of philosophies behind it. So basically this film says that, you know, it's built around the value of money. It's a bit of a critique of greed and inequality, but ultimately the heroes triumph by making extreme amounts of money, and that becomes like the ultimate goal. Whereas the screwball comedies of the 30s and 40s had a bit more of a different class issues at the centre of it. So do you think that, Simon, do you think the message here in this movie is one of sort of capitalism, or more of a critique of it?
It's an interesting one. I think that, yeah, on the surface, that criticism seems to stick, that really it's about the value of money. And if you want to get people who have money back, then take their money away from them. And if you can get more money in the process, then even better, and you are the winner. However, I don't think you can deny that within it, we've got a sex worker who is this ridiculous tart with the heart character who just kind of helps Dan Aykroyd, although they're from completely different worlds. You know, they couldn't be more star-crossed lovers. There's something in that, you know. Here's this woman, she's sassy and she's resourceful and she's lovely. And yeah, she may be a sex worker, but hey, sex workers are nice people too. And then you've got this black guy who starts off being a small-time grifter, just out for himself, and he's a liar. And kind of he has this streak of honesty going through him. He's on the grift, but he doesn't try to steal. The only time you really see him steal is when he's in the Duke Brothers' house with Denham Elliot, and he's going, oh, look over there, and putting stuff in his pocket. And you kind of think, he knows this is weird. You kind of give him a pass for that.
Yeah.
But the way that he and Dan Aykroyd are at the very beginning, you know, he stops saying good morning to people. He's sort of so into himself. He just went, nods. And the way that they are from completely different worlds and they come together and they understand one another a bit more. And it's sort of saying, it may not have the traditional screwball big banner moral going through it, but it is kind of, hey, a bit sixth form, people are people and everybody's nice when you get to know them type thing, which isn't a bad message, actually, when all is said and done. It's not the worst message.
No, indeed. You sort of touched on the verisimilitude of, good word, of some of the performances, and I actually wanted to talk about John Landis' direction that he brings to this. Really, it's like a gritty, at times it's almost like an episode of Hill Street Blues. There's just this like gritty realism, almost that opening credits has got a cinema verite kind of montage of people going about their various ways of earning their keep. And I really thought that was a interesting kind of style that he brings to the film as well. You can see that this day and age it would be a more glossy, slick piece, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Philadelphia, early 80s Philadelphia, it looks like early 80s New York. And yeah. In that, it's sort of the last time I saw a film that looked like that, as you say, is Joker, where they've gone, kind of gone back in time. Yeah, it's really interesting, that opening sequence. It's like you say, it's like a documentary almost, and it's the people in it are real. So they're not kind of film star good looking. There's a very much sense of a fly on the wall camera. It's almost sort of saying, in a big city like this, there's a million different stories and we're going to concentrate on one. The snow piled up by the sides is dirty. There's rubbish everywhere. It's an interesting, the look of it is really interesting. And even at the end on the New York Stock Exchange floor, they were extras, apparently, 300 extras, but it feels incredibly real. It feels as though the camera has sort of found its way in there. I would argue as well that the over-the-top prison scenes as well, the precinct itself feels very real. And the way that some of the stuff is shot on the steps of buildings, there is a real interesting feel about it. And maybe that's why we're prepared to kind of accept the film and the characters and the plot so readily, that John Landis sets it in this world that feels incredibly, incredibly real. So it doesn't matter that the characters are kind of over the top. We don't understand. We've chosen our heroes / heroines. We've chosen our baddies. And we're sucked in along it because it feels so real.
I think that's maybe why the whole train sequence feels a bit weird to me. Because it does feel like a completely different film. I don't just mean the bit in the carriage where it's like a sort of a Hollywood version of Mind Your Language, where you've got all these stereotype races leaping around the place. But the whole party and something that's obviously meant to be a gorilla, but it's clearly a man in a suit. You can tell that Rick Baker wasn't on board for this one because it's quite unconvincing. And Jim Belushi leaping around. It just feels like a completely different setup. It's weird.
It's like it's gone all a bit SNL for the third act.
Which it has.
Yeah. So that was really interesting as well. You know, making me basically dissect my childhood favourite. And I did feel that as well. I was sort of, what the hell's going on here? Why have I always sort of just bought into this ridiculous, there's a kind of slightly handsy gorilla, Jim Belushi, proving again that he is no John Belushi. But I think that as a kid, we were just glad to have a Belushi in the
any
film.
Any Belushi will do.
Yeah, you know, we missed John Belushi so much that he slightly got a pass. But you're right. There's that New Year's Eve party. The two train porters, they're so one-dimensional in a way that the Duke brothers aren't.
Yeah,
it's kind of the writing suddenly goes down a notch. That scene is, with the racial stereotypes, is just, what the hell?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only saved, and I don't think one gets to say this a lot, but it's only saved by a much implied but never seen gorilla rape. And there's
the gorilla rapes Principal Vernon from Breakfast Club.
And there's not many films that you can say this was all kind of looking a bit sort of shoddy. But then, thankfully, gorilla rapes a man in it, and we're back on track with the comedy.
Because didn't somebody quite sort of famous, and I'll use this term very carefully, pull out because of the gorilla rape scene? There was somebody who was actually involved in Watergate, was meant to play the Clarence Beeks character. And he was offered the role, and he took it. And then he read the bit where he gets bummed by a gorilla and said, I'm not doing that. No. I don't think it was Deep Throat, but I'm not sure who it was.
Yeah.
Well, not Daniel Day-Lewis?
not David Cameron?
Yes. Yes, that kind of last third. Again, you're pulled along by it. You're giddy with the idea that they're hatching a plan. There's a great sort of U-turn in the script, because the script has sort of gone as far as it can go, hasn't it?
Yep.
You know, they've done this Prince and the Pauper thing.
Mm. Yeah.
The bet had been won. In some ways, you wanted to know how they're going to dump the Eddie Murphy character, Billy Ray Valentine, and how are they going to bring Dan Aykroyd back into it. Then they sort of go, well, we're not even going to do that. Dan Aykroyd's proved himself unworthy of our patronage. So you're like, oh, wow, where's this going? And so you're sort of ready for that third act. Because I was wondering whilst I was watching it last night, I was like, this is awful, this bit. This bit's not really that good. Why have I always liked this? And then I realized, because I kind of been carried on, I want to know what's going to happen. And because the hook in the story is so good, I'm prepared to kind of go with it wherever the twists and turns may take me. And actually, I was laughing at the end as they're sort of sending the gorilla off with his with his girlfriend, and everybody can see that this is a man in a gorilla uniform, and everyone can see that those aren't real people from Africa and Switzerland, but I don't care. And yes, they're going to the stock exchange to do something that I have no idea what they're going to do, but I know that it's clever and it will end in the Duke's ruin. So there's something to be said for this film, that it is so convoluted and it is so kind of one-dimensional, and yet it still works.
It's a real contrast of sort of highbrow with overly complicated futures trading plot that none of us can quite decipher, with what's going on the train and the total broad comedy there. It's
I think it's really confident to go with that ending.
Yeah.
Seeing as we've just seen the entire train sequence and other comedy films where somebody gets revenge, or even a heist movie where somebody gets revenge on somebody else, the ending is almost sometimes feels like, you know, could potentially be like a bedroom farce where they're running from hotel room to hotel room and planting things and hiding in wardrobes and all this trickery.
Yeah.
So to do it for something that nobody understands is such a bold move.
It's interesting, actually, because I remember when the prequels came out, people saying, what the hell is George Lucas doing? You know, it starts off with blockades on Trade Federation routes, and, you know, how are kids supposed to understand that? You know, newsflash, when I went and saw Star Wars age 8, I didn't know what an empire was or a republic was. Yeah. I didn't have the slightest idea. All I knew is that there were goodies and there were baddies. And I kind of thought it was really interesting that people were going, oh, Trade Federation, this trade. No, as long as he establishes that these people are good and these people are bad, if you can write around that, if you're able to plan the plot to have these points that they hit, which reinforces that storyline, you can pretty much get away with anything. And I think if it meant that sort of somebody went off and tried to find out what frozen concentrated orange juice futures were,
then
good on them. But, you know, in some ways, I like the fact that it doesn't pander to us in the plot. You know, the comedy may become incredibly broad and silly in that last third, but the integrity of the plot, from my knowledge of TV executives, and I'm sure it must be the same in film, they're not all the brightest stars in the sky. You know, you'd have thought that somebody would have gone, I don't really get this ending, but maybe it was just kind of this collective, what's it called, that, not the Stockholm syndrome, but that Stanford experiment. Nobody wants to say, if somebody did understand it, maybe they just got lucky and a Paramount executive had bought frozen concentrated orange juice thing. I love the ending. So all his acolytes go, yeah, us too. We don't understand it, but yeah, if he does, we do. It's the only thing I can think.
I think the critical thing, though, with that ending is that while you don't understand it, you have an instinctual understanding that it makes sense to someone and that it actually holds water, and you feel impressed by the cleverness of it and that you understand enough of it to kind of go, yeah, this works. Wow, this is really smart. I'm not quite there, but...
Yeah, and it's the one time that actually we get to see... Up until now, we've seen Eddie Murphy be very street smart and all the rest of it, and it's the one time that Lewis is allowed, that Dan Aykroyd is allowed to... shine. It's alluded to at the beginning that he's got a kind of a good nose for these things and that they should trust him on his instinct. There's the small scene as they're walking into Wall Street where he says, it's a bear pit, do this, don't let them see fear, blah, blah, blah. And it's the first time we actually see him schooling Eddie Murphy in something, which I think is good as well.
Yeah, because that's always the thing as well, is there's that very early scene where Eddie Murphy goes to the office for the first day and he picks it up instantly. He gives them a lecture on why they shouldn't really be selling because the price is going to go up, and he runs into this whole thing. So he almost makes it look like it's easy. But then, of course, when we get to the final act, it's the exact opposite. You almost think that Winthorpe's like pretending he's a charlatan, he's making something really easy look really difficult. And Eddie Murphy almost kind of proves that. But Not at all.
They have that little explanation scene, don't they, of what commodities brokers do, where they lay out the different plates of food in front of Eddie yes. Murphy, and then they explain that this is a pork belly, and you know, this is where bacon comes from. You know, bacon, which you might find in a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. And it's the one time that Eddie Murphy stares down the barrel of the camera and just looks like these condescending pricks. It's a really good moment.
But I love that look to camera. It's brilliant.
Yeah. It reminded me of the movie The Big Short, a movie that I really loved. I thought was incredibly entertaining. Scene after scene is a little gimmicky way of explaining to you all these complicated financial structures and things. And it reminded me of a little microcosm of that movie. And I still didn't understand, 95% of what The Big Short was talking about, but I felt carried along enough to kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, Margot Robbie in a bath full of bubbles explaining fiscal policy will do that to you, though, won't it?
Yeah. Never been more captivated by the subject in my life.
What is with you and baths, Simon?
No idea. Which seems a good segue to go into the Jamie Lee Curtis role here, because you cannot talk about Trading Places. You cannot talk to anybody of our age who saw this film without talking about Jamie Lee Curtis in this. I watched a quick documentary last night with the making of, which just had must have been a kind of 25-year anniversary or something. And they kind of had interviews with all the stars. And Jamie Lee Curtis said, this was a great film for me because it got me out of that Scream Queen thing and established me as a comic actress and everything else. And then Dan Aykroyd says, Jamie Lee Curtis, she was brilliant and she was superb. And yeah, there's that scene, which she does, and she's so well-rounded and she's so great and blah, blah, blah. And he's trying to make jokes about it because you can see that he feels awkward, and it's probably 5-10 years before Me Too. And he knows it's sort of not quite right. But if we look at that scene, there's an amazing revelation in that scene that isn't her taking her top off. The first bit is when she takes her wig off. When she takes her wig off, I think I remember going, oh my word, she's got short hair. And you never really saw film stars with short hair before. So she's taken this off and she goes, she's got short hair and she's beautiful. She's absolutely beautiful. And then she takes her top off and you go, oh my word, she's taken her top off. She's a major actress in this role.
Yeah.
And she's the most amazing looking woman that my adolescent just gone through puberty thing has hit. And she's standing there and then she turns around and kicks the door and she says, this is a business transaction. Don't think that you're getting any of this. So I would argue, possibly badly, that I would argue that the nudity...
I'll back you up on this. I don't even know what you're about to say, but...
Yeah, I agree.
I would say that the nudity within it, in terms of the script, it doesn't feel massively gratuitous. What makes it feel such a huge moment is that Jamie Lee Curtis is possibly the most beautiful woman committed to celluloid that you've seen in a state of undress at that stage. And that's what it is. She's amazing looking.
I agree with you. I don't think it's particularly exploitative, that scene as well, because she clearly has the power in that scene. You know, she's actually almost doing that to kind of put Dan Aykroyd's character in his box and say, this is a business. Yeah, there's nothing in this apartment that's going to come for free. Yeah, and again, I might just be retroactively trying to justify why that scene was the scratchy part on the video for me. But
she's beautiful. She's absolutely...
And you're right. She, it's an iconic moment of an absolutely beautiful starlet,
And there's also far more exploitative nudity in other John Landis films. It's kind of a trope of his, isn't it? And I think he did famously add it to the script of this. When the script first came to him, it was a lot more kind of PG. He basically said he wanted some nudity and he wanted some profanity in it.
I'm trying to think of who were the actresses who would have been around at that time doing that stuff. And I remember Karen Allen, who'd been in National Lampoon's Animal House and obviously was in Raiders. I can't remember her name, but the blonde actress who's with Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop, who sort of plays the sidekick there. I can't really think of many marquee name actresses. And I think that that is also the impact of as I say, sort of a big name star, somebody who we'd all seen in Halloween, doing a scene like that. And that tends to happen in cinema sometimes, doesn't it? Where you hear of an actress, or somebody will, and again, I can't think of one off the top of my head, maybe you guys can.
Well, do you remember Halle Berry and Swordfish?
Precisely.
Scene was like that. There was a massive stir, and I think there was talk about the fee that she got for that. And
yes,
yeah, and that was a real, that was a moment. Yeah,
Renny Russo doing in the remake of the Thomas Crown Affair. But interestingly, though, both those people were established actresses when they did it. And
I bet you John Landis was a regular Stanley Kubrick that day.
Yeah,
you
know? Yes,
take 87. I think we just need another one, Jamie.
Yes, yeah. She's proud of... Jamie Lee Curtis is proud of that as well, isn't she? And you kind of... Knowing which member of Spinal Tap is she married to? Is it Michael McKean she's married to?
No, Christopher Guest.
Christopher Guest. So you know she's got this great sense of humour. And if you want to see an exploitative scene for me with Jamie Lee Curtis, it's True Lies. I felt massively in the scene with True Lies. But I guess... You know, we have to take into account her feelings in this, and she is obviously an actress who is comfortable with doing these scenes and obviously understands that she's got a great figure and it's being committed to celluloid. That will be eternally how she looks. I don't think that sort of an actress of the caliber of Jamie Lee Curtis, when she came to do that James Cameron film, if she did not want to do that scene, I believe that she could have said, no, I don't want to do it.
Absolutely. And she said that, you know, John Landis absolutely changed her life and her career with casting her in this film. And without Trading Places, there'd be no Fish Called Wanda, you know, which you know, is arguably her greatest performance. So
I believe she won a BAFTA for this, didn't she?
Yeah, I think she did.
I think it's interesting as well. I did see, I don't know if it was a trivia page or an interview with Jamie Lee Curtis, where she was asked, prior to Trading Places, you'd just done horror films. So how did it feel to become mainstream and not be exploited? Because they ultimately assumed that there was a lot of exploitation of women in horror films. And she quite rightly said, look, when I was making horror films, I was never asked to do any nudity. As soon as I hit Hollywood, that was the first thing they asked me. And also, I was paid $1 million for Halloween 2 and only about $50,000 for Trading Places. So
wow,
this is really interesting. She's great in it anyway, and she's definitely part and parcel of the whole Trading Places experience. We talk about Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder taking over those roles. You'd be hard pushed to think of somebody who, I don't know who we would think of casting or who would come in and be cast in that role and make that same sort of splash. I guess it would have to be somebody like a Goldie Hawn, wouldn't it, really? Or somebody, I don't know.
No disrespect, I'm pleased it wasn't Gilda Radner.
Yes.
In the role.
Yeah. The Bonham Carter to Will Wilder's Tim Burton.
Exactly, yeah. We probably haven't actually articulated the bet, have we?
No.
It seems to be an ongoing argument between the Duke brothers. One of them believes that it's all about upbringing and heritage that makes you a good and successful person. And the other one believes that it's more about the environment that you're currently in. That's about right. It's nature versus nurture, basically, isn't it? So it's all very eugenic.
I guess the driving motivation of the plot, will, especially in the first half, is the idea that the Duke brothers, who I think it's Randy, you know, as in Randy and the Jackson 5, Randolph is reading the science journal, isn't he? And much to Mortimer's consternation, because Mortimer is just always thinking about making money and how he can make money and blah, 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 he's getting angrier and angrier as he's sort of saying this idea that breeding is everything. And he wants to show that environment is everything. And he wants to show that the best breeding and the best stock comes through. And so that is the basis for their bet, that if they take their best employee, Lewis Winthrop, and put him down on his luck and take everything away from him, that he won't come out on top, or that he will come out on top. Let's see how that works. And they do that by using just who happens to be the black guy who they've just bumped into hours before, who's run through the club. And there's that great line, isn't there? Is there a lawyer in the house? And Eddie Murphy demands a lawyer after he's run through the club and everybody just looks at the floor. And so by swapping the Dan Aykroyd character with Eddie Murphy's character, giving everything to Eddie Murphy, taking everything away from Dan Aykroyd, how will they react in this situation? And that is the main part of the plot. And of course, Dan Aykroyd's fall from grace is absolutely awful. The friends that he has who are just, I mean, his best friend wants to go out with his fiance. Yeah. His fiance ends up going out with his best friend in a matter of days after he's found to not only have stolen from the club, but also be a pusher of PCP.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was expecting one of you to go jump in and go, it's not PCP, Simon.
It's angel dust. Yeah, his friends are very much remind me of Patrick Bateman's co-workers.
Yes,
in American Psycho.
Close harmonizing.
It's just that bit with it serenading the girls in the tennis club. It is the worst excesses of Fraser and Niles, isn't it? It's them at the worst.
Completely.
It's horrific.
Yeah, it's sort of nice for Lewis to get some real friends at the end of it, you know, a sex worker, a grifter, a black guy grifter, and a randy old butler.
Denham Elliott, what do we think of Denham Elliott in this?
He's wonderful, he's always wonderful.
Yeah, he is always wonderful, isn't he?
I meant to look up last night, but perhaps you guys know. Which came first? Was it Arthur or was it Trading Places? I've got a feeling it was Arthur.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because the whole film, I was thinking of John Gielgud's character as kind of an analogous to Denham Elliott in this.
Yes.
And, you know, you can imagine almost a spin-off movie, the two of them pairing up.
But because of this, I think Arthur was first, because Gielgud was offered this role.
Ah, okay.
And he turned it down, presumably because he'd just done Arthur. Also, Ronnie Barker was offered this.
Yes.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he turned it down because he would only work within sort of 10 miles of his house, which is in like Hertfordshire or something.
Absolutely amazing.
So he turned it down for travel reasons, yeah. Can you imagine Ronnie Barker in this? I know he's versatile.
He could do the stately, you know, upper crust gentleman occasionally, and the two Ronnies, you know, he would...
Would have been an interesting one.
Yeah, but
Denham Elliott does feel like a carbon copy of John Gielgud's character in Arthur. And you kind of got the feeling that it was sort of a box-ticking exercise of, well, British butlers, the audience like British butlers, look at how well they did with Arthur. And didn't Gielgud get an Oscar for Arthur?
Yes, he did,
Yeah, he did.
And then he comes back in Arthur 2 as a ghost, ridiculously. Yeah. So the British butler was sort of becoming a trope, I guess.
Mm.
But yes, the whole thing is driven by that bet. And then when they feel that they've proved the bet, they're ready just to dump the guys, cast them to one side. And that's when we as the audience get behind them as they plot their revenge. Both of them team up to plot their revenge on the Duke brothers. And they say it's inspired by The Prince and the Pauper. But There's Pygmalion, My Fair Lady in there as well, isn't there? In the way that they take Eddie Murphy, Billy Ray Valentine, and they sort of school him. As I say, there's a lack of montage. I would have loved to have seen a montage in there, because that's what every 80s film should have. But
a training montage would have been wonderful, yeah.
Yeah,
it would have been good.
Of him just reading the Wall Street Journal every day.
yes, and circling stuff.
Yes, because he does. I think we're just supposed to assume he has just such a knack for it, aren't we? That he's
naturally smart. Doesn't need it. He's street smart.
Yeah. It's like you were saying before, Simon, like perhaps it would have been nice just to have a bit more of a kernel of backstory.
Yes.
Just to be able to hang a little bit of character on.
Because the only backstory we have is where they say, oh, I bet you came from a broken home. And he goes, yeah, we were broke, so what? But we kind of worked that one out already. And I suppose what you were saying earlier, Simon, where they say, oh, if only your parents were still alive to see this, Lewis. I think that's just put in there as a little marker to say that when he's got nothing, he's got nobody to turn to. He's got no family.
Yeah,
obviously, his friends have turned their back on him, so he's literally on his own. I think that's the only reason that line's in there.
Unfortunately, for if you're kind of hardwired like us three, and you sort of want to know, you know, we're the kids who stayed behind when everybody got up when the film ended to read the credits and to to see who the best boy was and everything else. It's kind of not enough, which is as you leave the cinema. I'd always thought that of why was he sort of friends with these horrible people? Why were his parents dead? Why did he not own that house himself? There's so many questions that it throws up that you kind of feel I would have loved 10 minutes less in the train carriage for 10 minutes exposition in a way. Yeah. That's what I realized when I had to come and revisit it again and look at it in a different way.
I also think the wager is slightly weighted because their bet is that, of course, will Lewis turn to a life of crime? But they've literally taken everything from him and thrown him in jail. I think anybody is going to turn to a life of crime after that. There's nothing else you can do. So it's a bit unfair.
And the bit where we sort of haven't spoken about at all, and that this is the weirdness about this film, is he comes into his own as this demonic Father Christmas, this demonic Santa Claus, stealing food from the buffet. So when Lewis is really down on his luck and he's deciding he's going to go and plant drugs on Billy Ray Valentine and get back to the Duke and Duke's Christmas party, as I say, Christmas runs all the way through this, and it's even got the what my friend calls the festive gooch. That space between Christmas Day and New Year's Eve.
That's brilliant.
So
I'm stealing that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, the holiday taint, if you will.
Yes. The season's greeting, perineum, but we. It's so Christmassy. So at the beginning, there's, you know, you see the decorations are in every scene. Jamie Lee Curtis decorates the tree. Dan Aykroyd dresses up as Santa Claus. There's a New Year's Eve party. Why do you guys think that it's not thought of as a Christmas film? And before you answer, just to let you know, they do think of it as a Christmas film in Italy, where it is apparently played either on Christmas Eve or on Christmas Day every year.
Good for them.
It's one of their favourite films.
I've always thought of it as a Christmas film. Growing up in here in New Zealand, it was always, when I was a kid, every, around Christmas, New Year's. For some reason, it was this and The Woman in Red, speaking of Gene Wilder. Yeah, for that reason, I have always kind of thought of it as a Christmas film. And that image of him as the, the dirty Santa with the gun, I think, is one of the iconic images of the film. And even the themes, you know, there's a lot of talk about loneliness and, you know, who your real friends and real family are and, you know, what's important in life. I mean, it does seem to skirt by saying money is really what you need in life to succeed. But, yeah, I guess there's that thematic kind of relationship there too.
I think to a certain extent, even though they do say Merry Christmas and all the things that you said, Simon, because it's a bit grungy and a bit scungy, it doesn't feel like Christmas. If you say to somebody now, what Christmas films are on, they're going to go, The Holiday or Love Actually or something like that. And that's because you're bashed over the head with it.
Yes. And I guess as a kid sitting down to watch this with mum and dad when Jamie Lee Curtis is taking a top off and there's all the swear words and the N-word flying around, it's not exactly family viewing, I guess. For
come that on, scene was always a little Christmas present for me.
Come on, darling, you're about to miss Jamie. You're about to miss Jamie Lee Curtis's impressive rack. Come in, darling. Bring the kids. Is this the bit where the whore loses a kidney? Just for anybody listening, that's a line of dialogue. I'm not just saying that.
Yes.
The dialogue in it. What's the actor? Beeks. Clarence Beeks.
Principal Vernon.
Principal Vernon. What's
his name? Oh, do you mean Paul Gleason?
Yes, yeah, Paul Gleason. He is a horrible, violent character.
Yeah.
You know, do you remember him on the phone when the woman is waiting?
That is about my favourite scene in the film. That one always just makes me laugh out loud. It's brilliant. The timing and the yes. ferocity of it is just brilliant.
Yeah, so, you know, there's nothing Christmassy about Paul Gleason's private eye.
He's not like BZ in Santa Claus the Movie, is he?
Yes, not at all.
He's great in the role, though. He does that sort of stern, you know, bastard so
yeah.
well.
Again, if this is yeah. kind of pantomime humour, and the Dukes of the Ugly Sisters, he certainly is the Wicked Witch character brilliantly.
Yeah. Evil Abenaza,
Yeah, we know where we are. So I guess, I mean, coming back to it, is it still any good? Yeah, I really enjoyed watching it for you guys, you know, well, for myself primarily, but for you guys to talk to. And it was a completely different experience watching it to kind of go, do I still really like this? I suddenly realised that there's a lot of films that I just watch for pleasure. And it kind of made me, I've been a TV critic off and on for sort of 25 years, and I've been a film reviewer. And I think it's the first time I've actually thought to myself, wow, you really do have a completely different sense of a film when you're watching it with a critical eye. When you're just watching a film for pleasure, the two things couldn't be further apart. And I guess that's why the sort of Rotten Tomatoes critics rating and the audience rating are often such a world apart.
Yeah,
I love this film. I love this film, watching this film for pleasure. Watching this film to kind of go, is it still any good and do I like it? It's not the 10 out of 10 that I've always thought it was. It's more an 8 out of 10, but that's still pretty good, and I'll still take that, I think.
Yeah, it's not about the score. It's about what it means to you at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think sort of saying what you're kind of alluding to is that Rob and I have had some quite big heartbreaks on this one, haven't we? There's things that we've absolutely adored. Yeah. And we've gone back to them, and I think, oh my God, it's almost like my whole childhood's been a lie.
Digby, the world's biggest dog.
Don't Digby me. That one still hurts. But my opinion of this, we did get a tweet from one of our regular listeners, which is @Wenders1022, who's from Southern California, no less, who said, when I mentioned that we were going to be looking at this, said, is it possible for a movie to be still good while also being terribly, terribly wrong? Do we think we've answered that tonight?
Yeah,
I think so. I think we've been able to make a case for the bad bits in this movie, and I put the bad bits in inverted commas, maybe the problematic, the challenging bits. It's a completely and utterly a movie of its time. And also, it's so well written that you kind of, that hides a multitude of sins. If you're having a great time when you're watching a film, that collective mood of watching a movie with other people where you've laughed a lot and you've enjoyed the characters and you kind of feel that there's been a redemptive arc that, you know, you might not have understood the intricacies, but you understand the main themes, the baddies get their comeuppance and the goodies, you know, have their day. It fulfills every one of those things. My son came in last night as I was watching it. He's 19 now. He's seen me watch Inside Man before because I had to, I joined a podcast where we were reviewing Inside Man. And I said, oh, I'm doing another podcast review. I'm watching this film, Trading Places. He said, I remember this. I said, hey, you want to sit down and watch it with me? And he goes, no, I'm not in the mood for an old movie tonight.
Oh!
well, you know, it is 37 years old.
That's indeed. But what the thing about that was, it's a film that I have no problem turning to my kid and saying, hey, do you want to watch this film with me? And I think if I felt it was problematic in any way, if it was felt that there was something that he wouldn't enjoy, I wouldn't do that. But of course, all your choices are a reflection of yourself. So if you make your kids watch something terrible, then they will go off going, dad's got terrible taste.
Yeah. So no, Dad, no more Russ Meyer films.
Would you let your kids watch this with you? Would you, your teenage kids, 13, 14, would you let them watch this film with you?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you what I watched with my daughter tonight because she's only 10. Oh, fuck it. We watched The Omen tonight with my 10-year-old daughter.
Whoa.
Nice.
Whoa.
She loved it.
Fantastic.
She thought it was great.
Dad of the year.
We're introducing her into horror, and she's really loving it. So
The remake or the...
The old Donna one, the old 76 one, absolutely. Wouldn't they go near the remake? Absolutely not.
How did she go when David Warner got sliced?
She thought it was brilliant. She thought it was fine. She actually said, oh, it still looks good, even for the olden days.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, that's good. That's
brilliant.
So I'm a proud parent. What about you, Rob? Would you let your eight-month-old watch this?
Well, we don't... he only had his first proper screen time yesterday in the car on the way to the airport, just to kind of placate him. And we had the iPad on of, like, the Wiggles and things. It was like he was on baby crack or something. It was amazing. Yeah, I mean, I still thought this was good. I was pleasantly surprised, actually. I hadn't seen it for probably 15, 20 years. And in that time, in my head, I had thought, oh, God, this is not going to age well. You know, there is going to be a lot of problematic stuff, a lot of really dodgy kind of attitudes. And it wasn't as bad as I thought, actually, going in. You know, it was always comfort food for me, and it was still comfort food watching it. A little less of that camaraderie you feel like when you are watching it with your older brother or your friends and things, and watching it alone, it's kind of not quite the same. But I thought it was good, yeah. The thing for me that I didn't struggle with, but I was surprised how little I liked Dan Aykroyd's character this time around. As a kid, it was always like the two of them were the heroes, and I know that you're supposed to kind of dislike Winthrop, but yeah, I just didn't really like him at all throughout the whole film, and just thought Ophelia could have done a lot better. She should have ended up with Eddie Murphy, you know, and Eddie Murphy just absolute raw power and talent and just so charismatic, and it's great to see that sort of captured on film. So yeah, good film.
Yeah, I can't really argue with either of that, really. I still really enjoyed it. I think we've highlighted some of the issues that people may identify with it in this modern age, but I think one of the sort of strange problems I have with it is the pacing of it. It's called Trading Places, and they don't actually trade until about the 55th minute. It takes quite a long time for the let's call it the enticing incident, for that to embed and for them to actually have swapped places convincingly. Yeah, it takes a very, very long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that time could have been spent, like you said, looking a bit more at their backstory or giving them a bit more of a character. But once it gets going, it really does get going. And like you said, Rob, Eddie Murphy just owns every second that he's on the screen. There's nothing else that you can look at.
I just suddenly had a massive penny drop when you said that, but then you didn't say what I thought you were going to say. You went, it's called Trading Places, but they don't actually trade. And I was like, yeah, they don't trade until the end of the film. We never actually see them on the trade.
Well, they're in a trading place, aren't they?
It's a trading where they trade. And then you went and said, oh, no, they don't actually trade. I was like, yeah. Oh, but yes, but it works that way as well. This is a clever.
Yeah, it's a good
I've only realised there's a double meaning to that. I only just realised that.
Me too.
I was today years old.
The original title, I think, was Black or White.
Yeah.
Which, again, is ironic because John Landis directed that video for Michael Jackson as well.
Indeed.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's less morphing in this film.
Less Norm from Cheers.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's three still goods with some small reservations. I like that. That's good stats. Yeah.
Good.
That's good for us.
Thank you, Simon, for bringing that in.
Guys, thank you so much. And thank you for keeping everybody entertained in this pandemic year with the podcast. And keep up the good work. It's great. Really, really great.
Thank you.
I love the premise. And now having been a guest on it as well, it's a really lovely experience going back and looking at your old films, as my son would say. These old films and re-evaluating them.
As long as he doesn't call Return of the Jedi an old film, I'm okay.
So before we leave you, Simon, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
I've been doing, this has been sort of, when you're a freelance writer, broadcaster and all the rest of it, this year has been a very strange one because there's not a lot to do really. And thankfully, the podcast reviewing has been keeping me busy. But I have been working on my website, which is called kidrated.com, and it's basically a TripAdvisor by kids. Right. So if anybody's visiting London with their family and want to know where to go, my site has reviews on it done by kids for families about all the major places in London. It's kind of like 250 attractions have been reviewed by kids who will probably be the same age as your kids. So there's some toddlers on there, there's some teenagers. Yeah, so when people are ready to travel again and they need a bit of help, go and have a look at that site.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I've had a look at it and it's great. And it's something that I would love to see in New Zealand. We're, of course, not rubbing it in, but we are allowed to travel around and go on holiday. I've just had a little holiday myself. And so looking at kids' reviews of stuff would be perfect for me dragging the little ones everywhere and finding something that they're really going to be into. It's such a good idea.
That's a lovely idea.
Great, thank you. Once I've kind of covered, I want to do Kid Rated New York, and I want to actually franchise the idea and do different cities. Mm. But also I want to do different verticals as well. So there, some kids have done some film reviews on there as well, and some book reviews, and trying to make Kid Rated a kind of a catch-all title for any reviews that kids want to do. So, yeah, let them spoil their books and films.
Yeah. They'll be spoiling Dora the Explorer, the movie. Or something.
Listen, Dora the Explorer movie is really good.
Okay. All right.
It's really brilliant.
Oh, Chris jumped in there pretty quick, didn't he?
Yeah. I will defend the Dora the Explorer movie. It's so good.
Sit down, Chris, and unclench those fists.
The knuckles are going white here. Okay, time to wrap it up. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping. So if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook. And if you want to email us, it's StillAnyGood@gmail.com. And please, please, please give us the Christmas present we want and rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's been wonderful having you on.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you again for giving us a lovely review.
Yeah, so brilliant.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Very, very heartfelt and genuine. It's a great show. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, mate. And we will definitely have you back on again at some point, because this was great. Really, really good talk.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Okay, guys. All the best. Have a very Merry Christmas.
Thanks a lot. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Cheers, Simon.
See you.
Take care. Merry Christmas.
Bye.
Bye.
Fuck off.